This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In the 2 weeks since President Bush nominated his friend and White House counsel Harriet Miers to the U.S. Supreme Court, controversy has swirled around her religious beliefs, her qualifications, and her position on hot-button issues, especially abortion. Conservatives are divided, liberals uncertain. Unlike John Roberts, who was confirmed as Chief Justice last month, Miers never served as a judge at any level and has no background or record on constitutional law. In an effort to quell the uproar on the right, the president yesterday brought six judges from Texas to the White House to express support for a woman they described as a brilliant lawyer who broke through the glass ceiling. Today, we're learning a little bit more about nominee Miers. This morning, the White House released Miers' written replies to questions submitted by the Senate Judiciary Committee and included a questionnaire that she filled out for a pro-life group in Texas when she ran for city council in Dallas. We'll talk about her answers and how they may shift the debate and talk with a friend and former colleague of Harriet Miers. Later in the program, an emergency in Taunton, Massachusetts, where a failing 150-year-old dam threatens to flood the city. But first, Harriet Miers. If you have questions about the resume and background of the Supreme Court nominee, give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us here in Studio 3A is Jan Greenberg, Supreme Court reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you very much.
And in terms of news, the one-page questionnaire she completed for Texans United for Life in 1989 appears to be generating a lot more news than the 57-page questionnaire she filled out for the Senate Judiciary Committee.
That's exactly right, and I expect that that's what we'll be seeing leading the news tonight and leading the newspapers in the morning. In this questionnaire, she acknowledges that if Congress were to pass a constitutional amendment prohibiting abortion except if the life of the mother were at stake, she would support that. That is a very strong anti-abortion point of view. That's much more than we ever knew about John Roberts' views on abortion, and that is enough to immediately prompt Senator Feinstein, for example, to release a statement already saying she's very troubled. We now have had statements immediately from any number of women's groups raising concerns about the Miers nomination. So what we saw in the last 2 weeks was a rollout by the White House designed to shore up support among social conservatives. They stressed her religious views. They stressed her loyalty to George Bush. That alienated a lot of other Republicans who wanted to talk about the law. So as you said, the White House tried to repackage this presentation of Harriet Miers and roll her out differently, focusing on her legal qualifications this week. But this questionnaire that we have today, again, focusing on her personal views about abortion and her anti-abortion viewpoint, is certain to fuel debate now from the left, the Democrats, who have been largely silent as they've watched the Republicans fight over this nomination back and forth.
Well, you talked about reaction from Democratic senators, from women's groups, feminist groups responding to this. What about on the other side? Were conservatives who had been opposed to her coming around to support her now?
I don't know how much headway this will make. The social conservatives, the White House campaign over the last 2 weeks, they reached out to religious groups and religious leaders to stress that she went to an evangelical church and that she was close to Bush, that she, in a sense, would vote the right way. They made a lot of headway with those groups, but that alienated another segment of the base, the segment that thought, you know, that they really needed a heavy hitter, an intellectual leader on the Supreme Court, and they were very disappointed by Harriet Miers. So all those efforts by the White House the last 2 weeks to shore up support among social conservatives backfired with a significant element of their base that wanted to talk about the law. This questionnaire today is unlikely to, again, make any of these people feel any better because it's not about the law. It's not about philosophy. It's not about her judicial theories. This is a questionnaire she filled out in 1989 talking about her personal views on abortion. And again, this already is much more than we knew about John Roberts, the new Chief Justice, about his views on abortion. And that was enough for many Democrats to vote against him because they didn't know enough.
Well, Democrats split 22-22 on John Roberts. It may not be so close this time around. Obviously, we'll have to see. And there's much more to come in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee in terms of testimony from Harriet Miers. But the White House said today in response to this questionnaire that her personal beliefs on abortion don't suggest that she has determined which way she would vote on the legal question of Roe v. Wade.
That's exactly right. We've seen other stuff come out already, though. Friends of hers in Texas saying they believe that she would, in fact, vote to overturn Roe versus Wade. And there's not a lot she can say at this point. Now that she's been nominated, she certainly is going to be getting questions about her views on abortion, her views on Roe versus Wade. This questionnaire obviously says she is anti-abortion. Now, what do you do if you're a senator on the Judiciary Committee wanting to explore what that means once you're a justice on the Supreme Court? She's not going to be able to say, despite my personal views, I think Roe versus Wade should be upheld, or I think Roe versus Wade should be overturned. That's a case that very well could come back before the Supreme Court. We've seen time and again that these nominees just can't answer those questions. So it's a difficult position for this nominee to be in. It's going to be very difficult for her to get away from this questionnaire because she just is not going to be able to satisfy the senators on either side of the aisle.
During the John Roberts nomination process, the White House said his religious beliefs were irrelevant, shouldn't really be considered. And of course, in nominating Harriet Myers, the president said her religious background was indeed part of her life and part of the reason why he nominated her. Aren't her religious beliefs now open for examination before the committee?
I would say no. The White House was trying to back off of some of that because it came under tremendous criticism from the left and right after saying all summer that the views of John Roberts on religion should not be part of the process, and then to suggest that Harriet Myers was an acceptable nominee because of her religious views. So they do seem to be trying to back off of that. White House press secretary last week said he thought it was unfortunate that there had been so much emphasis placed on religion. Of course, that prompted all the conservative Republicans who were up in arms about this to say, well, you know, it's the White House that's been making religion an issue anyway. So going forward, the White House is going to try to focus on the law. But the Democrats now have a lot to work with on where she stands on abortion, and how they get to the bottom of how she thinks the law on abortion should be is going to be very difficult.
Again, if you have questions, 800-989-8255. Email us, TOTN@NPR.org. And let's talk with Chris. Chris calling us from Camden, New Jersey.
Hi. I was wondering, I've heard so much about how the fact that she's not been ever had experience with being a judge before, and I was wondering how big a factor that is. It seems ludicrous to me to put a justice on the Supreme Court who's never been a judge before, but has this ever been an issue in past appointees?
Oh, yes. And historically, if you look back, you don't have to be a judge to be on the Supreme Court. It's kind of a pattern that's developed recently. And many senators and people who are advising the White House on this process encourage the president to look outside the judicial monastery, maybe to a senator. Earl Warren, for example, would come on the court as governor of California. But what the White House now has to do in this nominee is to say, her legal accomplishments and her legal skills merit her being the 110th justice on the Supreme Court. They're going to try to say that she's had all these accomplishments, that she's been an impressive lawyer in Texas, she was on the Dallas City Council, she's worked in the White House. But there are thousands of qualified lawyers out there, many of them women. The task for the White House now is to convince the American people and the senators that she has these legal skills that distinguish her, that make her worthy of being the 110th justice.
Chris, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Much is going to hinge on, we're talking now, I think the hearings are being talked about now for maybe the 7th of November or even the 14th to give presumably Harriet Myers time to get ready for them. And at this point, a great deal is going to hinge on how she appears before the committee.
Oh, people have been saying that these are going to be the most significant hearings that we've had for a Supreme Court nominee in quite some time. For one thing, we don't know that much about her. She literally is a stealth nominee. Much less is known about her views on the law than any nominee that we can recall in her speeches. There's just not a lot there. So we don't know a lot about her. The senators have already been raising questions about how much she, in fact, knows about constitutional law, how much time she needs to prepare to get ready for those hearings. So it suggests that it will be in mid-November, but they want to try to wrap this up before Thanksgiving. Keep in mind, Justice O'Connor is sitting up there on the Supreme Court waiting to retire, but not retiring until her successor is confirmed.
Jan Crawford Greenberg, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Jan Crawford Greenberg is in the Washington Bureau of the Chicago Tribune and covers the Supreme Court, and she joined us here in Studio 3A. Let's now talk with one of the supporters of Harriet Myers. Jay Sekulow joins us. He's chief counsel for the American Center for Law and Justice, and he joins us from their studios in Virginia Beach. Nice to have you back on the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what do we learn about Harriet Myers today? How does this, particularly the Texans United for Life questionnaire, shift this debate?
Well, I think it's a change that you're going to see coming now, focused from groups on the left that I expect, groups like People for the American Way and Planned Parenthood, that are now going to come out opposed to Harriet Myers, where they were opposed to her before, but they didn't have a lot to sink their teeth into. I think they're going to look at this questionnaire. And it's not, by the way, just the Texans United for Life questionnaire, but her answers also, which I thought were great, which obviously they're going to not think are so great, with regard to her role of the role of judicial activism and the role of what a judge is supposed to do. So I think what you're going to see now is not so much a focus on a fight between the right, so to speak, but now I think it's going to expand and maybe be significantly mute out the fight on the right when you have now the advocacy groups probably by tomorrow morning, if not by this evening, fully engaged. I think what Jan Greenberg just said is right. By this evening's news, this is going to be the story.
Mm-hmm. So you see this returning to it's a little strange to put it this way, but a more traditional fight between liberals and conservatives.
No, that's a good way of putting it. I mean, I think it's going to be more of the traditional advocacy roles are going to be played here. I mean, there's one thing that I think has been answered today, and that is this is not someone that has come to her views out of a vacuum. I mean, she's been thinking about these issues, and her questionnaire shows it. By the way, the questionnaire also shows that she's had complex constitutional issues that have been litigated all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States. So some of this idea that she's, what's her experience level? She's had real trial experience, real Court of Appeals experience, 3 cases that have gone to the Supreme Court, which she was fighting for the court not to hear them in 2 of them. But I do think you're looking at it more of a traditional fight. I just am hopeful, and it may be overly optimistic here, that what we're going to see is not that all of a sudden you've got this exclusion, and that because she might harbor personally a pro-life conviction, that somehow she's now disqualified from serving.
But you mentioned the 3 cases that went to the Supreme Court. She did not argue those cases before the Supreme Court.
No, she in 2 of them, she wanted the court not to hear the case. So one, she wanted the court to hear it, and 2 of them, she wanted the court not to hear it. She had won successfully in the Court of Appeals at the Fifth Circuit. So, but these are still, look, I do a lot of Supreme Court practice. I mean, most of my practice is at the Supreme Court, but as anybody will tell you at the Supreme Court, it's not just the oral arguments. The briefs are very important. She obviously has that experience.
Stay with us, Jay Sekulow. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll continue talking about the nomination of Harriet Myers and her response to questions both in the past couple of weeks and back in 1989 when she was running for city council in Dallas, and how that changes the debate over this Supreme Court nomination. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about the nomination of Harriet Myers to the Supreme Court of the United States. Earlier today, the White House released Harriet Myers' written replies to questions from the Senate Judiciary Committee and a questionnaire that she filled out from a pro-life group in Texas in 1989. You can read Myers' responses to the Senate Judiciary Committee's questions at our website at npr.org. In fact, both of those questionnaires are listed on our website if you'd like to read them. Again, that's npr.org. You're also invited to join our discussion here. Our number is 800-989-8255. The email address is totn@npr.org. Right now we're speaking with Jay Sekulow, Chief Counsel for the American Center for Law and Justice. And Jay, just before the break, you were talking about how this will cease being so much an argument within the conservative movement and return to being a more traditional argument. There was a statement issued today by Senator David Vitter, the freshman Republican from Louisiana. He issued a statement said, "My top questions are, does she, Harriet Myers, have a consistent and well-grounded conservative judicial philosophy, and what objective evidence is there of it from her life's work?" How would you answer the senator?
Well, I think you have to look at her job responsibilities, what she's done. And when you look at that, you see a lawyer that has had not only great trial experience with the real cases in real courtrooms, but she's been advising the President of the United States, and she served as a deputy chief of staff, deputy political advisor, basically, for the President on matters of policy. So this is not someone that comes to the law without a known record. I mean, what's lacking here is she has no appellate experience or any courtroom experience as far as being a judge. But that, as Jan Greenberg just said, your last guest, that's pretty common within Supreme Court history. In fact, it's only recently that you've had most of the nominees, all of them basically being Court of Appeals judges. Chief Justice Rehnquist, before he was nominated to the court, he worked for the Justice Department. Lewis Powell was the president of the American Bar Association and was a private lawyer in Richmond.
Clarence Thomas worked for the Justice Department as well.
He did. He also served as a – he was a court of appeals judge for about a year. Mm-hmm. So this idea that she doesn't have judicial experience I don't think is going to cut it. Now, I don't think for a moment that the debate on Harriet Myers is going to be over with among the right. But I will say this. I think one thing the White House has accomplished over the last 24 hours has been that the president's not backing down from this nominee, nor is Harriet Myers going to somehow withdraw herself. That's despite the protests coming from some friends of mine that would like her to back away. But I just – that's not going to happen. The president, if anything, the White House, I think, is indicating and signaling they're very committed to this nomination.
Yet, clearly, the president's trust me argument did not cut a lot of ice with some of your friends.
It did not, and which is interesting because the president has had such a great track record on the appointment of judges. My friends that are disagreeing with this wanted a different kind of pick. They wanted, and there's nothing wrong with this, and it's, I think it's a legitimate expression. I think some wanted a level of a joust in public, if you will, that would have been an educational system, part of an educational process, by having a noted Court of Appeals judge who has opinions out on various cases. That's not the direction the president chose to go, but I think some of this, what I call soundbite analysis, fortunately on your program and some of the others on this network, you don't have to deal with it that way. There's more discussion, but look, it's been a lot of soundbite analysis, and people that don't like Harriet Myers generally don't know her, and the few that do know her and don't like her don't really say it's her judicial philosophy. It's just they're saying there was a different bench the president could have gone to, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Jim. Jim calling us from Asheville, North Carolina.
Yeah, hi. I have a real concern about the whole attorney-client privilege issue here. I mean, she's been the president's attorney for a long time, and it is not beyond the scope of imagination that there could be some legal issues involving the Bush administration. And I'm concerned that there may be a lot of information that may not be accessible to any kind of legal program because of her relationship to the president.
She was both his private attorney for a while in Texas and, of course, his White House counsel, his attorney at the White House, Jay Sekulow.
Absolutely.
Yeah. How is it going to figure in?
Well, I think, look, the issue of what you're talking about there is the issue of recusal. And will a nominee or now a Supreme Court justice have to recuse themselves from a case because of either personal knowledge or what would be perceived as a conflict of interest? Interestingly, at the Supreme Court, the only one that decides that's the individual justice. It's not reviewed by anyone. But justices have recused themselves from cases. And Harriet Myers knows the context of judicial ethics. She served as the president of the Texas Bar Association, so she's fully aware of what's really at stake in those kind of – you want to avoid the appearance of impropriety. So I don't think that's going to be a significant issue because many nominees to the court have come out of government service, and they know when they have to exercise their recusal and when they don't. And by the way, Jim, you're calling from one of my favorite parts of the country, Nashville, North Carolina. Pretty place, especially this time of year. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks. I wish they moved the court down there sometimes. It'd be a blast.
Maybe not in the summer. Anyway, Jim, thanks for the call. Mm-hmm. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Stacy. Stacy calling us from Las Vegas, Nevada.
Hi, am I on?
Yes, you're on the air, Stacy. Go ahead, please.
Okay, good. I want to know, actually, how possible is it that if she did get nominated and confirmed and sat on the Supreme Court, how possible is it that she would have the opportunity to overturn Roe versus Wade? I mean, is this something we should really be worried about?
How often do these cases come to the Supreme Court? Well, I guess the Supreme Court gets to decide which cases it accepts.
Sure.
But have to come before her, correct?
Correct.
Well, of course. And let me tell you this, and I'm one that litigates a lot of the life issues at the Supreme Court of the United States. There's cases up there this term, not involving the right as recognized in Roe, but you've got the parental consent case that will be argued in November and November 30th. She may well be seated by then. We'll see soon. We've got a case involving RICO and pro-life protests that's up there. Now, the biggest case that's up there, and it is a big, big case, is that the Justice Department last month filed a petition for review on the partial birth abortion case. I think that is likely to be heard by the court. But that does not get to the right to abortion recognized in Roe versus Wade. You're right. To get to that case, it's going to have to be a fresh challenge. Those are not in the system right now because even if Harriet Myers were confirmed and even if she were then to say that Roe versus Wade should be overturned and even if Chief Justice Roberts and Scalia and Thomas agreed with her, that's four votes. You have to have five. And there's right now not five votes. And, of course, all that does is return the issue of abortion to the states. And they'll either regulate it or not regulate it or allow it or not. But the cases like partial birth abortion are the parental consent laws are the cases that are up there.
Okay. Well, that answers my question. Thank you.
Stacey, thanks very much for the call. And Jay Sekulow, thank you very much for being with us today. We know you're busy.
Thank you very much for having me.
Jay Sekulow is chief counsel for the American Center for Law and Justice, and he joined us from their studios in Virginia Beach. As Capitol Hill mulls over the recently released questionnaires completed by Supreme Court nominee Harriet Myers, we'll turn now to someone who worked closely with her in Dallas, Texas. Jerry Clements practiced law at the firm of Locke, Little & Sapp and joins us now from Cake Mix Studios in Dallas, Texas. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
I understand that you first met Harriet Myers in 1981 and later practiced law side by side with her in the late 90s. I wonder, has the picture that the media has painted of Harriet Myers, is that congruent with your knowledge of her?
Absolutely not. Harriet Myers that I know and that so many of us here in Texas who have practiced law with know is not the same person that has been described in the press recently, and we're all anxious for her to be able to get to her confirmation hearings and speak for herself and let the rest of the country and the Senate know exactly what we already know about Harriet Myers, and that she is an outstanding lawyer, an outstanding person of high integrity, and a very, very brilliant person.
You've met her. Is she a quick study? Is she someone who will, you know, well, just answer that. Is she a quick study?
Absolutely. I've had the opportunity and the privilege to work with her over the years in a number of very complex and complicated litigation matters. I've watched her do her legal analysis. I've watched her look at the facts of the case. I've watched her study legal precedent and find controlling issues that need to be addressed. I've watched her write briefs and develop legal arguments. I've watched her in the courtroom. I've watched her in the appellate courts. This is a very quick study and a person who works very hard to understand all aspects of any case before her.
There has been relatively little that she has spoken about or written about on questions of constitutional law. As you know, this disturbs many people.
Well, I just simply disagree with that. I think that that is not a fair portrayal of the career of Ms. Myers. For example, I can tell you that many of the civil cases that she has been involved with over the years have involved constitutional issues. There's a question in large nationwide class actions, for example, of whether a company can be sued in one state and still have due process complied with if the laws of that one state are applied to claims by people residing in all 50 states. There's always issues in civil litigation about whether a state can assert personal jurisdiction within constitutional limits over a non-resident defendant. Federal statutes are looked at regularly by trial lawyers such as Ms. Myers, and these are issues that we really deal with all the time. I know, for example, Harriet has done some fairly significant First Amendment work as well in representing some media outlets here in the Texas area. So I think to suggest that she hasn't written or thought about constitutional issues is an unfair characterization, and I haven't even begun to address the constitutional issues that she deals with on a daily basis as counsel to the president.
Well, again, this is Senator David Vitter of Louisiana, Republican, said today, my top questions are, does she have a consistent and well-grounded conservative judicial philosophy? What objective evidence is there of it from her life's work?
Let me try to address that. I've had a chance to look over her answers to her questionnaire this morning, and I think anyone who gets the opportunity to go to your website and look at that will be impressed and certainly have a lot more information than they might have expected. But I certainly think in this circumstance that if you look at what she has accomplished and what she has achieved, that there will be a recognition of the issues that she's dealt with along the way, the matters that she has addressed, and where she's going to come down on those. I also suggest that for the last several months, she's been closely involved in helping President Bush select judicial nominees for a number of courts. And I suggest that folks look to those nominees and the people that she has helped the president find and locate and nominate and get confirmed. If there's any question about her judicial philosophy, I think one can certainly look at the work she's done in the White House counsel's office to get a further feel from those nominations and her process of being involved in the vetting of those nominees. I think that's important.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Gene. Gene calling us from Coatesville, Pennsylvania.
Yes. I'd like to ask the question is relating to her appointment going to the top of a major Texas law firm. This has been aired as a major qualification for her. I don't understand what this has to do with her qualifications, because all that may indicate is that she's been very good at promoting herself in workplace politics, and that's what we would ask for anybody. Very many people in very many industries and professions are capable of getting themselves appointed to top positions. We don't necessarily hire people for major professional government positions or public servants because they've been able to attain executive positions. They get those. They can get those positions in various ways.
First woman to head a major Texas law firm, also the first woman to be elected president of the Texas Bar Association. But anyway, Jerry Clements, you worked at that firm. Go ahead.
Well, I did have the opportunity to work with Harriet and was at our firm, Locke, Liddell & Sapp, while she was in management. Let me address that. Our firm is pretty interesting. One of the things that is interesting about our firm is that people who actually campaign or engage in the politics of moving up the corporate ladder don't get very far in our firm. Our firm is one that really looks at people who have integrity, people who have leadership roles, people who are honest and can be trusted, and who are consensus builders within the organization, people who always put the interest of the organization ahead of their own. And that is how Harriet Myers made it to the top levels of management in our firm. This is an accomplishment.
What we're relying on is a business reference for appointment to the Supreme Court, because it seems obvious that in any other profession, to be appointed to a position of responsibility like this, her candidacy wouldn't even be considered. She's not a recognized expert in this position. She apparently has no publication record. She has not been any law professor at any university, and is not recognized for any expertise in constitutional law, unlike most of the Supreme Court nominees in the past who have not been judges.
Gene, I have to interrupt you to say that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Well, and I respectfully disagree. The fact that she was the first managing partner of a major law firm in Texas is only one small facet of Harriet Myers. And if you look to that in a vacuum, then you would be disappointed. But what I suggest is that people look at the questionnaire that she answered today. To suggest that she has no publication or written record is simply incorrect. To suggest that she has no experience in analyzing and dealing with constitutional issues is simply incorrect. I think you've been hearing one side of this story, and you haven't had an opportunity to hear about the other facets of Harriet Myers' legal career.
Well,
she is
I'll look forward to the hearing so we could find out what she has published and what she said in those articles.
Well, you can find out what she's published by, again, looking at that questionnaire that she answered from the Senate Judiciary Committee. It's on our website today.
Okay,
Gene, thanks very much for the call. And I'm afraid we're running a little short of time, but Jerry Clements, I wanted to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Jerry Clements practiced law with nominee Harriet Myers in Texas and joined us from Cake Mix Studios in Dallas, Texas. With us now is Jeffrey Rosen, professor of law at George Washington University, also legal affairs editor at The New Republic, and he joins us from his home office here in Washington, D.C. Jeffrey, good to have you with us again.
Hi, good to be here.
First of all, let me ask you, how did the answers to the questionnaires change things today?
Well, the answers to the questions about judicial activism and constitutional experience don't seem terribly controversial. There's boilerplate about the limited role of courts and so forth. You can glean a bit when she talked about the difference in the role of legislatures and judges. She said as a city council member, it was okay for her to vote against flag desecration, but the Supreme Court should approach the matter differently. By and large, though, I gather that the real controversy, of course, is coming with the White House's recent submission of questions that she filed as a city council member regarding her support for a constitutional amendment to ban abortion, and that may overshadow the details that are in the questionnaire.
It was indeed support for that Texas pro-life group's position seemingly all the way down the line, including that she agreed to, as a council member, should she get elected, oppose pro-abortion people on school boards, that sort of thing.
It's true. It's very striking to contrast that quite doctrinaire support with Justice O'Connor's record as a state legislator, where she considered similar issues. O'Connor actually opposed a constitutional amendment to ban abortion. She opposed restricting earlier term abortions, and she won the opposition of local Arizona pro-life people as a result. Jerry Falwell said all good Christians should oppose O'Connor. Mm-hmm. So they were in similar positions and reached quite different opinions about abortion. And of course, O'Connor on the court voted as a legislator very similarly to the way that she'd voted in the city council. So these opinions may indeed be revealing of instincts to vote similarly on the court.
More on Harriet Myers after we return from a short break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're talking about Harriet Myers and what we know about her thus far. Today the White House released her answers to questions written by the Senate Judiciary Committee, and a questionnaire that she filled out in 1989 for a Texas pro-life group. She was running for city council in Dallas at the time, where she advocated pro-life positions. Down the line, we're talking with Jeffrey Rosen, professor of law at George Washington University. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email us, TOTN at NPR.org. And Jeffrey, the political dynamic, the answers today, do they seem to shift that at all?
I gather that in response to the 1989 questionnaire, more senators expressed some doubt. Senator Schumer said, nobody can speak for me on Roe versus Wade, but said that he wasn't entirely confident. And some Senate Republicans have also expressed renewed doubts about what exactly she believes. Also, those who are concerned that she doesn't have enough constitutional experience may not be mollified or reassured by the questionnaire. She cites three Supreme Court cases that she worked on. One involved the question of whether Vice President Cheney was a resident of Wyoming or not. But the others involved small pro bono cases that the Supreme Court ultimately decided not to hear. She concedes that most of her legal experience was in civil cases, which she discusses in some detail. But it's not a terribly reassuring picture of someone who's thought deeply about constitutional issues in a whole range of areas. So in that sense, it may not shore up her case appreciably.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Barack. Barack calling us from San Francisco.
Yes, I'm actually an attorney. And the previous guest, when she talked about the issues, that constitutional issues that Myers dealt with, including jurisdiction, that raised alarm bells, because that's something that every lawyer deals with, you know, when they're about to file a case. So I wanted to get a bit more information about those three cases that she dealt with, and whether there's really anything there as far as substance.
Can you flesh those cases out a little bit for us, Jeffrey?
I know that she talked about what she learned from the clerk, the judge for whom she clerked, Judge Estes, and she said that he was vigilant about exercising power in a very prudent way, and believed that judges should never reach out to decide anything more broadly than they had to. So it suggests that based on that experience, she was sensitive to limits on judicial power to decide in the first place, and to the degree that the caller is concerned that her vision of judicial restraint might not lead her to open the courthouse door very broadly, then that might be supported. She does, as a civil lawyer, she's acutely sensitive to jurisdictional issues, to standing, to mootness, all these technical doctrines that prevent courts from hearing cases too broadly, and she discusses case by case how some of those issues came up in some of the larger litigation she handled, such as Microsoft and other cases like that.
What the Microsoft case, that's a pretty major case.
It was, and the fact that she persuaded Microsoft to hire her, not a large New York or Washington lawyer, but a lawyer in Texas, suggests that she was no legal slouch, and to the degree that it's been suggested that she had no reputation as a lawyer, that's belied by a case like Microsoft. That was not an insignificant achievement, but it wasn't a constitutional one, and her critics are saying the talents that it takes to litigate a complex commercial matter or civil matter like that are very different than what it takes to sit on the Supreme Court and decide constitutional cases.
Barack, were you asking about cases like that or about the three cases that she that did go to the, or at least got recognized by the Supreme Court, if not argued there? I think Barack has left us. I did want to ask you, Jeffrey, about the article you wrote that was published in this week's edition, or last Sunday's edition of the New York Times Magazine. You wrote that the Republicans have painted themselves into a corner over the issue of affirmative action for the Supreme Court, that, in a sense, President Bush was determined to name a woman to replace Sandra Day O'Connor.
It's true. The familiar Republican position is that gender, like race, should be a tiebreaker to choose among equally qualified candidates. And Senator Cornyn, the Texas Republican, had that wonderful quote in September, "I don't know whether John Roberts has a twin, perhaps a sister, or someone with a Hispanic last name." But in fact, there is a superbly qualified Republican woman, a female John Roberts, who could have been appointed, and this is a woman named Maureen Mahoney.
Testified on John Roberts' behalf.
She did. She, like Roberts, was a former clerk for William Rehnquist, a former deputy solicitor general. She's 51, Roberts is 50, and both of them are widely respected as among the top constitutional litigators before the Supreme Court of their generation. So it is a nice irony, isn't it, that having imposed a gender quota on himself, Bush chose a less qualified woman who has no published position on affirmative action over a more qualified one who was paid to argue against affirmative action. It turns out that it was Mahoney's successful representation of affirmative action supporters before the Supreme Court 3 years ago that led the White House to be cool to her nomination. So that's why I said that in the debate about diversity versus meritocracy, Republicans have painted themselves into a nice corner.
Republicans are not alone in having a contradictory position sometimes.
They're not at all. Democrats, too, find themselves struggling to justify their intuitions about gender in the court. After all, the familiar Democratic position is that gender matters. It's a version of the essentialist argument that we need women judges because they will be more sensitive to women's issues based on their experience in fighting discrimination. And there may be some areas, especially women's issues, where Justice O'Connor's background, for example, the discrimination she experienced, influenced her votes on the court. But I was very struck to find the statistics. I hadn't realized this before. Between 1994 and 2004, Justice O'Connor voted less frequently with the other female justice, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, than she voted with any other justice except for John Paul Stevens. So the idea that in most areas gender was determinative is not supported by the performance of these two distinguished women justices.
So that if being a woman justice does affect your views and your opinions on the law, it doesn't emerge from looking at the voting records of those two women justices?
It doesn't appear to. Now, of course, this is an interesting and very contested subject. There have been lots of studies on the matter. Several studies of federal district court judges have found no evidence that gender affects judicial decisions in cases involving discrimination and civil rights. There have been some studies on the other side saying that in cases involving family law and divorce law, there may be slightly more of a correlation between gender and outcomes. But, of course, women's issues as a whole make up a tiny percentage of the Supreme Court's docket. Generally, they're just not at all a salient. And for this reason, if you were determined to have a woman to reflect a particular point of view, that probably wouldn't be a good way to go.
And finally, Jeffrey, before we let you go, earlier in the program we spoke with Jay Sekulow, a Myers supporter and conservative, who said that the release of these questionnaires, particularly the elaboration of her position on the abortion issue, is going to transform the debate into a more traditional liberal conservative debate and not so much on an argument among conservatives here. Do you agree? And how does that? How would that change the dynamic?
It's a very interesting suggestion. Do I agree? I suppose he would know more than I about the internal fissures among conservatives. But my sense is that there's a certain group of conservatives, in particular libertarians and the intellectuals, who are concerned about Myers not only because they think she wouldn't overturn Roe, but because they think that she just isn't smart enough to really carry the conservative flag in a way that would transform the law in a whole range of issues. So those conservatives are unlikely to be mollified even by reassurances of her social conservative credentials. But to the degree that Democrats, as a result of these new revelations, are backing away from their initial support and Harry Reid is expressing more caution, that may complicate her situation because, after all, just a few Republican senators have to defect, and then if a few more Democrats could really create some serious trouble for her.
Jeffrey Rosen, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Jeffrey Rosen, professor of law at George Washington University, legal affairs editor at The New Republic, and he joined us from his office here in Washington.